KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. New Mexico's governor and top health officials are trying to fend off a flurry of lawsuits by business owners who say financial losses caused by the state's pandemic health orders amount to a regulatory taking and should be compensated. The administration of Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is urging the state's Supreme Court to intervene and defuse the lawsuits. This week, an attorney for small businesses said state law supports public compensation for the pandemic response. Arguments are scheduled in January at the Supreme Court. At least 14 lawsuits initially filed in district court describe pandemic-related health orders as a regulatory taking that merits just compensation to businesses. Well, it is just another reminder that vaccine distribution cannot come soon enough as the pandemic continues. And in a New Mexico State University town hall this week, university officials outlined their role in the state's vaccine distribution plan. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
New Mexico State University is partnering with the New Mexico Department of Health to help distribute the COVID-19 vaccine in southern New Mexico. An allotment of vaccines will be stored on campus in an ultra-low freezer, capable of holding up to 180,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine. NMSU Chief of Police Stephen Lopez says the university will first be tasked with helping to vaccinate health officials, with a special emphasis on those working in rural counties.
We'll then take care of additional healthcare workers, possibly from up to 8 counties, is what the State Department of Health has asked us to help out with. We do have the facilities here at NMSU so that they don't have to try to ship a fragile vaccine out to a county in New Mexico that just doesn't have the ability to receive and use it well. So instead, those people can come here, get vaccinated, and then get back to work.
Lopez says the university is currently preparing to receive its first doses this month. The entire state of New Mexico is expected to receive over 17,000 doses from Pfizer in the first round of distribution.
The equipment's already in place to carry out the vaccine effort. We've tested various components of the plans to make sure that they are working well. And that's a good thing because we're now just about a week away from when we might see the first vaccines start rolling into our area, though again, in very small numbers. We're continuing to engage in regular coordination and are now training staff specific to their expected vaccines, whether that's the Pfizer vaccine, whether that's the Moderna vaccine, because they do have some differences in how we handle them and in how to actually deliver them.
During phase one, healthcare workers and the elderly will be among the first to get vaccinated, followed by other essential workers in phase two. The second phase is projected to begin by late February, depending on the availability of the vaccine. Dr. Catherine Hanley, a professor of biology at NMSU, spoke about what people should expect from the vaccination process.
The way that the vaccine is administered is that there's an initial dose, you wait 3 weeks, you get a second dose, you wait 1 to 2 weeks, and then you should have full protection. And the data just rolled out from the FDA, where we learned that after the initial dose, there's about an 82% efficacy, though there's some error around that estimate. But after the full treatment, so the full two doses, protection goes up to about 95% effectiveness.
She also projected that immunity to the virus will last for approximately 12 months before people will need to get the vaccine again.
We don't know how long immunity from the vaccine is going to last because the trials have only been running for about 2 months. And frankly, we don't know how long immunity to the natural infection is going to last because this pandemic hasn't had its first birthday yet. But all the signals are that immunity will last for about a year and then it will start to wane. And we do see people becoming infected for a second time. So that even people who have been authentically infected with SARS-CoV-2 will still probably want to be vaccinated to avert that second infection.
NMSU Chief of Police Stephen Lopez says it is possible to get through all phases of their distribution plan before people need to be revaccinated.
It is absolutely within the realm of possibility to get everybody vaccinated from an actual effort standpoint. The bigger question is going to be, are people willing to come out here and get vaccinated? I'm comfortable getting it right now. Hopefully, we'll be able to give the information to people that get even more people in our community ready as well.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
More pandemic-related news this week. Do not let your guard down yet if you've already had COVID-19. That is the message in our next story. It is rare, but some people are reporting second battles with the virus. Texas Tech Public Media's Sarah Self-Walbrick shares one Lubbock man's experience.
Stephen Macias says when he first tested positive for the novel coronavirus in August, he felt like he had a bad case of the flu.
Second time was the bad one.
Yes, you heard that right.
Like it was on a whole nother scale.
75 days after his first diagnosis, Macias again tested positive for the coronavirus. He says he never tested negative in between his bouts with the illness. In late October, as the hospitalization rate began to rise in Lubbock, Macias was admitted to a local hospital for low oxygen levels. The man in his 30s says he's doing better, but still feels fatigued and often struggles to breathe.
It's a serious thing. Like, people say, oh, well, you're going to live through it. But no, even if you live through it, it's not a experience you want.
Macias says his doctors told him he seems to have caught it twice. It's hard to say without more tests. Both times he fell ill, Macias says there was a bad outbreak at the call center he works at.
There's two ways to look at that. You can look at somebody that becomes ill and still tests positive as a continuous low-grade infection.
That's Dr. Craig Ryan, Regional Chief Medical Officer for Covenant Health.
Or you can actually have a documented case where a patient acquires COVID-19, tests positive for it, gets over it, becomes asymptomatic, and then becomes ill again and again tests positive for it. Now, that's the definition of a second infection.
The Centers for Disease Control reports few cases like this, but recent research suggests it's possible. Other coronaviruses can spread similarly. But traces of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 have been detected in people up to 3 months after their initial onset of symptoms. So it could be more like a flare-up. As the pandemic continues, these are the kinds of questions researchers are working to answer. Lubbock Health Authority Dr. Ron Cook says even after surviving COVID-19, people should take precautions.
I would not take any chances. Just because you've had it doesn't mean you should be nonchalant.
I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick in Lubbock.
Well, there was some good news this week amid the pandemic. State economists are predicting a rebound in New Mexico state government income for the fiscal year that starts in July 2021, on top of multi-billion dollar financial reserves. Economists for the legislature and three state agencies said this week the state anticipates an increase in general fund revenues of $163 million over current annual spending obligations. That is roughly a 2% increase. The state is likely to finish the fiscal year in July with $2.4 billion in financial reserves. That leaves New Mexico well positioned to maintain funding for essential services in public education, public safety, healthcare, and more amid the pandemic. Well, of course, another major challenge of this pandemic has been in education. Remote learning continues to cause problems in our region and across the country. In depth, here's KRWG public media intern Xavier Dominguez.
Some parents are facing an adjustment nearly as difficult as the challenges facing teachers and students. With jobs and other responsibilities, they're adjusting schedules with the kids at home. Parents like Jessica Segura of Las Cruces.
My son was the only of the little ones that were in school. He was in kindergarten, so that was definitely a learning curve and trying to figure out how to get things done via Zoom and assignments and really keep him on track as best as I could and still work.
Segura is not alone. Megan Garcia is a parent of two at Highland Elementary in Las Cruces. She says remote learning is challenging, but it's getting easier.
I feel in a lot of ways. At first, whenever it started in spring, it was rough. There were no clear expectations from the district. My second grader was in first grade at the time, and they literally gave us this packet that was put together, and it was kind of poorly put together. Like, the formatting was off when we printed it. It was really, really hard. This year has been a completely different experience. His teacher is very on top of things, clear expectations, clear communication across the board. I feel like he's getting a lot of that individualized attention that he wasn't getting prior to.
Mariana Zuniga has both elementary and middle school children to keep track on while she attends New Mexico State University.
The oldest ones, they kind of remember a little bit, but the younger ones, I actually have to sit down with them and make sure they're paying attention, because they don't sit down. The little ones, like the kindergartner, he won't sit down.
A Pew Research study reports 74% of K-12 parents are highly concerned their children will fall behind in school with a mix of in-person and online instruction. Blanca Arrojo is the director of the Teacher Education Program and an associate professor in the College of Education at New Mexico State University.
So I think our creativity is really stretching out and we're getting creative.
But creativity only goes so far. Arrojo says using platforms like Zoom may be draining for some students, especially the younger ones.
Zoom fatigue or Google Classroom fatigue, right? We get tired of Zooming and of being on the screen. So we've kind of had to learn how to incorporate both out of the screen teaching and on the screen teaching. So we need to be creative in ways that we can have work for our students to do outside of being on screen, but also be prepared to be on the screen and learn as well.
Jessica Segura empathizes with her kids, who say they're ready to return to school. Part of what they're missing is a social interaction.
They want to be out there and playing, and he'll ask me, and he's like, when is coronavirus going to be over so that we can go and play with our friends? And that's the hard part of them not knowing when, not being able to have that social interaction with other kids.
During these unprecedented times, Brenda Enriquez, a mother of three in the Gadsden Independent School District, has brought the classroom home.
The beginning was a real challenge, but I decided to make them say, for example, my kindergartner that works behind me, to make him like a more school type of environment versus just being at home on the couch or on their room. It's a lot easier for me and for them to transition into, you know, okay, it's time for school.
Professor Arrojo says there's still lots of work to be done to ensure every student gets an education, even if it's through a computer.
There's still a lot of work to be done in that area. It's a really hard thing to be going through to where you're there with people and now all of a sudden you don't have that interaction. So we're trying to figure that out. And like I know with my student teachers, I teach the student teaching seminar. So I'm working with those students who are out doing their student teaching. I think they're working very hard with their cooperating teachers out in the schools to figure out how to create those interactions with students so that students still get to share and get to laugh with their classmates and get to work together in projects and stuff. But I think we have a long way to go in that area, like learning how to do that effectively to where students are really participating with each other and sharing.
A Pew Research study found just 30% of K-12 parents are satisfied with online instruction only. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Xavier Dominguez.
More economic news now related to the pandemic. A natural gas pipeline that would have connected an oil field in New Mexico and Texas to markets in the Gulf Coast has been halted as the fossil fuel industry struggles during the pandemic. Officials with Permian Global Access Pipeline withdrew their application to build the 625-mile pipeline. It's a big hit to the economy for New Mexico and Texas. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission first approved the request to begin the application process back in 2019. Permian Global Access Pipeline President Joey Mahmood said that current market conditions meant the project was no longer financially viable and the company could resume if the market recovers. While Congress continues to debate a new COVID relief bill, many are hurting. Some thoughts from commentator Walt Rubel.
Early in his political career, the knock against Bill McCamley was that he never had a real job. Now, it could be argued that he and David Scrace have the two toughest jobs in the state. Scrace, the state's Secretary of Health and Human Services, is charged with helping us stay healthy. McCamley, Secretary for Workforce Solutions, is charged with helping those who've lost their job. In both cases, there's a lot of help needed. New Mexico has been more restrictive than other states in addressing the coronavirus pandemic. That's undoubtedly saved lives and reduced hospitalizations, but it's also resulted in more businesses closing and more workers losing their jobs. New Mexico's unemployment rate held steady at about 4.8% throughout 2019. By this July, when $600 weekly benefits from the Federal CARES Act were ending, it had climbed to 12.7%. The number of displaced workers seeking benefits went from an average of about 600 to 800 a week to more than 60,000 by early April, when so many calls came into the state unemployment line that they crashed the system. Each month since then has brought thousands of new displaced workers seeking benefits from a system that they've paid into for years. Our state long ago exceeded its capacity to help all of those who are deserving. McCamley told legislators during a November 24th special session that we've borrowed about $156 million from the federal government to meet our unemployment obligations, and that number is going up by about $10 million a week. The cooler temperatures have brought the deadly second wave of the pandemic that experts predicted last spring. Former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb warns that we're likely to see 4,000 deaths a day in the United States next month. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has imposed tougher restrictions in response to the increase in infections. That will surely lead to more people losing their jobs and needing assistance. The situation is not sustainable, but it doesn't need to be. Vaccines are being rolled out just as this second wave is taking its toll. The end of this nightmare is in sight. We just need to get through what is expected to be a long and deadly winter. The election of Joe Biden will bring two changes to our nation's effort against this virus. The first will be a unified and consistent message on prevention based on science and research. That's the good news. However, with a Democrat in the White House, Republicans in Congress have predictably rediscovered their distress over budget deficits. It's part of the hypocrisy we've come to expect from both parties each time there's a change in power. It's business as usual, but these are unusual times. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's columns appear in the Local Viewpoint section at krwg.org. His opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. Well, as businesses are hurting during the pandemic, there are government officials all over the region and all over the country who are looking to help, including officials close to home. The Las Cruces City Council met this week to discuss lowering business registration fees. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Business registration fees will be reduced to $5 for 1 year, following a unanimous vote by the City Council. Approximately 2,500 businesses pay the usual $35 registration fee to the city each year. City Deputy Director of Economic Development Francisco Payeras says lowering the fee is a way for the city to support local businesses amid the pandemic.
This is with the purpose of supporting the businesses that have been deeply affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. This would be effective upon request for business registration license or upon renewal of a new business registration license. That is, whenever a business is registered with the City of Las Cruces, rather than charging $35, we will make this to be $5 for a period of 1 year, Mr. Mayor and members of the City Council, so that all businesses that are either creating a new business or they're having a renewal, since we do our renewals on an annual basis, they can have access.
Councilor Tessa Abeda-Stuvey felt the fee should be waived completely.
If we're going to be helpful in this way, I do feel that just not having the fee as an entirety would be would be beneficial. I mean, businesses still need to register, that is required, but if there's a way not to have any fee towards that, I would be in favor of that.
City Attorney Jennifer Vega Brown says the goal of keeping a small fee is to encourage positive business practices and ensure registration continues. She also indicated waiving the fee had a potential to go against the anti-donation clause, which prohibits the city from giving away select funds.
One of the motivations for suggesting just a much lower fee is because we want to encourage registration. If there's no registration fee required, the motivation to register, usually the conversation was that it would be diminished. So we really want people to register, but businesses to register so that we can track them and we can have them participate in other activities that are available to them and us knowing that they're a registered business.
Many on the council indicated the city needed to continue to explore other ways to help small businesses. Councilor Ioana Bencomo says utility support should be expanded.
I know that we have the utility assistance, but that's obviously for the Las Cruces utility. That doesn't include El Paso Electric, that I think it's an important way to circle back. Again, I think it's some of those hardest hit businesses. What is every possible legal way that we can be, you know, supporting them and extending that olive branch as a city?
Bencomo also emphasized the different ways businesses have had to adapt in order to stay afloat this year, and stressed the council needs to make helping the establishments a top priority.
It's important to explore everything, right, and get really creative. I've noticed that businesses are doing that on their own. I know that some restaurants are doing their own delivery now, right, as opposed to relying on like a third party to deliver their food. I think, you know, resiliency is such a tricky thing, right, because it comes from often a place of struggle and pain, and it's not always good, but I think we have a lot of resilient people in this community. So as much as we as a city can support folks, I think is good. I'm excited for this council to continue to bring back any further recommendation.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Well, amid the pandemic, there is hope for some new business in the state of New Mexico. Cautious optimism, you might call it. The push for the legalization of recreational cannabis has really picked up in recent years in the New Mexico legislature. This week, we present part of the podcast Growing Forward for conversations with elected officials who support legalization. The moderators include Andy Lyman of New Mexico Political Report and Megan Kamrick of New Mexico PBS.
We spoke with Democratic State Representative Javier Martinez, who's been sort of the point person for the most recent attempts at legalization. His push for legalization seems to be less about potential revenue and more about restorative justice.
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest drivers and motivators for me in sponsoring and championing recreational cannabis legalization is the social justice aspect. The war on drugs has been a complete failure, not just here at the national level, but at the international level. I grew up along the border with Juarez, El Paso, and I've seen firsthand the violence that the drug war has created south of the border. And in my life here in the United States, I've seen the impacts of that war as well, particularly on communities of color through incarceration, criminalization, stripping people of any opportunity for a better life based solely on cannabis possession convictions. So to me, it's important that when we work on legalizing cannabis, that social justice is at the forefront of that fight.
This is probably a good time to bring up the term marijuana. It's not often talked about, but there is a school of thought that the term itself is rooted in racism.
Smoking pot's illegal.
Let me get a pound of your Swedish G-Wack.
Buzz kicking in.
The term marijuana has historical racial undertones dating back to the creation of the war on drugs. It is a word in Spanish, and it was used at the time to stoke fear in, you know, mainstream white American society, that this outsider drug was coming in and messing our kids, you know, messing with our kids, messing with our young people. That's where it comes from. You're absolutely right. Terminology matters. Words matter. And whenever you hear me talk about this, I talk about cannabis, and I flinch a little bit when I hear other people call it call it the M word, you know. But, you know, obviously people are free to use the words that they want. But in terms of this legislative process and the work that I'm doing here, the appropriate name, you know, the one that is most closely related to its scientific term is cannabis. And I believe we should be using that term.
I asked Martinez what he envisions as an equitable recreational cannabis program for our state.
What equity would look for me in this kind of industry is where we can ensure that everybody has equal footing and the same starting place as this industry develops. What we've seen in other states is you've had sometimes people with historical wealth, family wealth, most of the time folks who are not from communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs, right? They're not African American, they're not Latino, they're not Native American, they're not Mexican American. You know, they didn't grow up along the border, you know, in along a colonia. And to me, that's a problem. And we've seen that in many situations, whether it's Colorado or California or elsewhere. So an industry where everybody gets equal footing, right? And when it comes to equity, right, I'm sure you've all seen that that graphic of the three kids standing over a fence trying to watch a baseball game, and you've got these boxes, right? You know, if you're a Latino who grew up along a colonia whose parents were incarcerated perhaps for cannabis-related offenses, you grew up in poverty, but you tried your best, and here you are, and you're 40 years old, and this industry comes up, and you can't participate in it because you don't have the capital to be able to afford an expensive license. But the, you know, 40-year-old from California, Silicon Valley, moves in with his millions of dollars and gobbles up three licenses like this. That, to me, is an inequitable system, right? We've got to create procedures and policies within that framework to ensure that that kid who grew up poor in the colonia has the ability to participate.
I asked myself that question, and I've tried to come up with the clearest way to explain it. But it
That's Senator Jacob Candelaria. He's the first openly gay man to serve in the New Mexico legislature. He's also been just as open about being a medical cannabis patient. He, like Martinez, wants to see a bigger focus on restorative justice.
But it just strikes me as sort of cynical and inhumane that we in this country have been content and actively campaigned on both sides of the political aisle for decades to lock up brown, black, indigenous, and other people of color, and especially the poor, for cannabis offenses for decades. And it sort of offends me now that we're going to legalize recreationally, we're going to get rid of the criminalization. But we're not going to do that because we recognize that the decisions we made as a country over the last decades have been racist and have had enormous effects on people of color. And I will tell you, I, as an individual legislator, am fine without legalizing recreational cannabis until we are willing and able to have that conversation and to pass the right bill. And so I have no intent on voting for a piece of recreational legalization next session unless it incorporates fully and embraces these very difficult issues and proposes responses. Otherwise, I plan to vote no, because there is that inherent tension between pragmatism, right, and principle. But given all of the issues that I've been discussing and all of the evidence which says, right, that the war on drugs was a deliberate attempt by the federal government to imprison and incarcerate and destabilize generations of Black, Brown, and Indigenous leaders and communities, I'm going to side on the side of principle. Because if not, how can we as a country say that we take racial justice seriously?
Martinez is far from the first legislator to carry a legalization bill. In 2019, there was an attempt by a group of Republicans to create state-run cannabis stores. Also, technically, Representative Martinez's bill never really made it out of its first committee. The plan by Democrats was to have two identical bills, one in the House and one in the Senate. It became clear that the plan was to push the Senate version through first. Martinez confirmed that with us and said these kinds of measures generally stall in the Senate. In other words, they were not concerned with swaying voters in the House as much as the Senate.
So what was the roadblock for that Senate bill?
Well, in the committee where the bill died, there were some concerns raised about the length of the bill. Remember, Governor Lujan Grisham had asked the legislature to come up with a comprehensive bill, which almost by definition means it has to cover a lot of aspects.
So the notion that these are new concepts, the notion that the bill was too long, the notion that the bill was too complicated was simply, in my opinion, an excuse. The bill had been vetted thoroughly through the legislative process, and it had been vetted thoroughly through the governor's task force, which, as you may remember, started its work sometime last spring, 2019, and worked through the summer and into the fall with a wide and very diverse group of stakeholders at the table, including folks from the medical cannabis industry, patient rights advocates, law enforcement, public health professionals, and so many others. So, you know, that's what we heard in our conversations, that the bill was just too complex and too much at one time. But, you know, I as a legislator, we deal with a lot of big bills all the time. In fact, my legislative career has focused on big bills, whether it's cannabis or tax reform or early childhood. And the notion that a bill that is 100 pages, 150 pages long is too long is laughable to me.
I just want to take a moment to add some context to what Martinez said. Indeed, since 2015 at least, there have been a number of attempts to legalize cannabis, and each year there are little tweaks made, but for sure the 2020 bills were almost identical to some of the attempts in 2019.
And I asked Representative Martinez about the possibility of looking towards the promulgation of rules for some things instead of putting it all in the bill. He pointed out that while that is a possibility, in order to protect the medical program, he included the current law, which added to the bill's length.
If you were to go through the bill with a fine-tooth comb, you'll see that a lot of that material are actually statutes that have to be referenced. So it's not new material, right? You're going into criminal code and tax code and all kinds of different statutes that you have to reference per the way that we draft legislation. So when it comes to the substance, you're looking not at 190 pages. I mean, maybe you're looking at 100 pages. Number one. Number two, I would definitely be open to looking at different aspects of the bill that might be better addressed through rule. I can tell you that there's a whole lot in the bill already that we left up to rule. So it's not like we're prescribing everything in the bill. But if some of my colleagues in the legislature feel strongly about shortening the length of the bill, and if there are particular aspects of it that they would like to see through rule instead of through statute, I'd be very open to that.
One thing I watched happen during the 2020 legislative session was this idea of restorative justice used as a reason not to pass the bill.
What do you mean, Andy?
Well, remember, Representative Martinez said these legalization efforts don't really bottom out in the House. The Senate, even with a Democratic majority, always seems to have a hard time getting these bills passed. One of the holdouts on legalization is Senator Joseph Cervantes from Las Cruces. Now, to be clear, Cervantes has long been a supporter of decriminalizing or lessening penalties for cannabis. So the Senate legalization bill was heard by the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by Cervantes. Cervantes seemed to take issue with the restorative justice parts. Essentially, what the bill would have done is allowed those with criminal records related to cannabis to get a chance to be involved in a legitimate legal program.
Representative Martinez says this doesn't mean repeat offenders or drug kingpins like the infamous El Chapo, as Senator Cervantes claimed, would all of a sudden have access to the industry and a fat paycheck.
If you look at the bill, this is really geared toward people who might have had a conviction 20 years ago when they were 18, 19 years of age. And other than that, they've had a stellar, clean life other than those mistakes in the past. So no, El Chapo would not have been able to get a cannabis license. No career criminal would be able to get a cannabis license. This is really geared for folks who may have made a mistake in the past to ensure that they're not shut out of something that is now poised to make some people very wealthy. And as somebody who has experienced the violence, the grotesque violence of the war on drugs south of the border, you know, that's not something that I think we should even joke about. Folks like El Chapo are bad people. Folks like El Chapo are the products of failed economic policies here and abroad. Our bill was never meant to do that.
But a legalization bill is facing opposition from more than just those who morally oppose cannabis and those who are leery about people with criminal records.
Yeah, any attempt at legalization is also going to have to convince the tens of thousands of medical cannabis patients in New Mexico that their medicine won't be compromised. Just about every state that has legalized recreational use has seen patient numbers drop.
So that's because there's recreational cannabis and they don't have to go through a medical program. They just go get their cannabis?
Right. Prices may be higher to buy recreational use cannabis, but you don't have to get a certification from a doctor. You can just go in like any other store and buy your medicine.
But people are concerned that it might cost more. And so this is an issue that is, that's why medical patients are worried about a legalization program, because they want to have some kind of cost protection.
Right. Their concern is if the numbers go down enough, they might do away with the medical program altogether and just make it full legalization.
Martinez told us that his last bill would have protected patients in a few ways.
So our bill has three specific provisions that would do that. The first one is to keep the patient registry within DOH, keep the healthcare professionals in charge of that process, number one. Number two, eliminate gross receipts taxes from medical cannabis products and treat them like we would treat other medicines. That should make it more affordable for people, particularly for those who are chronically ill and have to purchase more product. The third provision is by using some of the excise tax revenue to create a patient subsidy program. And that one to me is especially important because it helps offset the cost of medical cannabis for, number one, seniors, and number two, people who are lower income. That brings a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more equity into the medical cannabis program. And should allow it, I believe, to grow with time, right? One of the arguments against us late last session was that when you create a recreational cannabis system, that you would have a lot of patients migrate from the medical program to the recreational program. So our response to that was, well, let's make medical cannabis less expensive for people to ensure that they don't migrate out of that program. And I believe that those provisions that we have in place would accomplish that.
Considering those with the financial means will probably pay extra for cannabis as a trade-off for not having to go get a medical card, I asked Martinez his thoughts on people doing the opposite. That is, calling in favors with friends to get medical prices.
That would be legal, right? And I certainly would hope that people would follow the law, you know. But when I go to the store and buy a bottle of wine, and I'm paying taxes on that, and you know, I know the bottle's not worth $20, but it's $20, right? And if I can save myself $3 or $4 by buying it on the black market, I'm just not going to take that risk.
Next week, we will hear more of the podcast Growing Forward for a closer look at the business of selling recreational cannabis. Growing Forward is a collaboration between New Mexico PBS and New Mexico Political Report, thanks to a grant from the New Mexico Local News Fund. Thanks for joining us for KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. It's great to have you with us. Early in the morning of July 16, 1945, the world's first nuclear bomb exploded at Trinity Site here in southern New Mexico. A new book details personal accounts of those who witnessed the explosion. Journalist Elva Oesterreich wrote about those accounts and the secret project leading up to the bomb in her book, The Manhattan Project Trinity Test, Witnessing the Bomb in New Mexico. Anthony Moreno talked about the book with Oesterreich. Here's a preview.
Elva, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us and talk about your book. Congratulations on the book. I'd like to start off with how you became interested in this topic and why you wanted to write a book about it.
Well, I lived in the Tularosa Basin for a good number of years. I worked at the Daily News there, and how I became familiar with the Trinity site. It's not in the Tularosa Basin, but just outside of it. And we did a project with the newspaper on the 60th anniversary of the explosion, which happened on July 16th, 1945. It was a really good, fascinating project where we recreated the time in the newspaper and talked to many of the people that we could find that had been there at the time and had memories of the explosion.
That's one of the things about this book I really enjoyed, was that you have all of these accounts, these personal accounts of people from the area, officials that took part in the secret project as well, and also even people who were young kids at the time, they shared their memories in this book. I kind of want to talk with you a little bit about how New Mexico was during that time of World War II. Can you kind of paint us a picture about what the state was like in this region?
Yeah, southern New Mexico was a vast, wide territory of ranchers and livestock, small cities and small villages. People out there in the plains, they ran their cattle, they took care of things. They didn't have grocery stores to go to. They grew their own food, caught their own water in their own cisterns, might go down the street to the mercantile and pick up their staples, rice and flour, and that was about it. Everything else was self-contained.
Can you share with us a little bit about the Manhattan Project, how it started, and really how many people were involved in it? And if you could also let us know just how many people were involved in it in this area.
So people from this area were really not involved at all. They didn't know, they had no clue what was going on. I'd say the Manhattan Project probably starts in the 30s, where people were understanding nuclear physics and fission and building on that. And then early in the 40s, the country became afraid, or the powers that be became worried, because the Germans were really developing nuclear technology. And so they decided they needed their own project to go forward, and that's what became the Manhattan Project.
You mentioned that a lot of people in this area, they didn't have a clue about what was going on. Most of the people didn't understand what was happening. Can you share with us a little bit about what people were saying was going on when you had all these folks being trucked in, this equipment being trucked into the area? What were people being told in the area by the U.S. government that was going on?
They were really being told nothing. I mean, they did realize, they noticed that things were ramping up, that something was happening, but they were just living their lives and putting their trust in the powers that be.
What sorts of misinformation was going around to different communities when they first heard about this explosion that took place, the mm-hmm. Trinity test?
Well, the papers put out, they were told that there was a munitions dump out of the Alamogordo airfield that exploded. That's all they knew until August 6th, when the first bombs went off in Japan, and everybody then realized that New Mexico was where the first atomic bomb ever had gone off. They had people in the ready. They had trucks and stuff ready to take people out of the basin and out of the area in case something went wrong. They never used that.
Let's talk about the explosion, that early morning explosion that surprised so many in our region, so many people living on their properties out in rural New Mexico. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about that explosion and what people recalled hearing, and what counties were really in view of the explosion?
So in view, you would have Otero County, Socorro County, more counties a little north of that. A lot of reports just reported the colors, the oranges, the glows. Many people felt tremors and shaking of their houses. A bit to the north is where the wind was blowing, and so you could see the ash in the air and the movement through the air. I don't know, I can't describe how huge it was and how frightening it was to some people. Some people thought the world was ending, and they were sure that the angels had come for them, their time to go.
That was Elva Oesterreich. Her new book, The Manhattan Project, Trinity Test, Witnessing the Bomb in New Mexico, is out now. To political news now, and of course, Democrats were not able to capture Texas for President-elect Joe Biden, but the November 3rd election showed the red state is trending more blue. Roz Brown has more from the Texas News Service.
In the days leading up to the November 3rd election, political pundits saw signs the historically red state of Texas might vote for Joe Biden. That didn't happen, but Democrats say they're optimistic about a turnaround in 2024. While Democrats gained ground in some cities and suburbs, President Donald Trump won Texas by roughly the same percentage of votes as in 2016. Claude Cummings with the Communication Workers of America says voters in most large metropolitan areas voted Democrats into office, but more field work is needed in smaller communities to reach Black and Latino voters.
As bad as we felt about not delivering Texas to the Biden-Harris ticket, because we really thought we were close enough to do that. But the good news is we still flipped some more counties to blue.
Cummings says the CWA did more with its labor partners than ever before, spending money on radio, phone banking, door knocking, and direct mail, but the pandemic prevented face-to-face conversation with potential voters. Derek Osabase is the state campaign coordinator for the CWA in Austin and says exit polls showed voters related most to the messaging about financial stability and security.
We feel like our program has been effective because we really lead with a working class message around good jobs, about regulation of companies. We were able to lead on issues, how to put people back to work.
Texas has 254 counties, and Cummings says to capture more of the vote share in 2024, Democrats need to bring their message to smaller counties where political activism may be lacking.
There are no Democratic candidates running. There's no Democratic presence. So we're going to have a very difficult time winning statewide offices unless the same infrastructure that we've helped build into the larger counties are built into the smaller counties.
Cummings adds, despite being smaller than many other unions and with many of its members out of work and staff laid off, the communication workers canvassing operation was the largest of any union during the election. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
More political news now, and some analysts have warned that President Trump's allegations, false allegations of election fraud, could be dangerous to the country, including commentator Peter Goodman.
Donald Trump's whining about alleged election fraud won't change the result, but it'll harm the country, and it's making Trump a bundle of money. His legal claims have no good legal arguments and no evidence, so courts laugh at him. A judge Trump appointed wrote an appellate decision pointing out that just saying elections are fraudulent without evidence doesn't make them so. Even Trump's Attorney General, William Barr, who violated Justice Department norms to help Trump, now admits there's no sign of significant fraud. Trump is laughing all the way to the bank. His election fraud fairy tales have brought in $200 million. People contribute to keep elections pure, and Trump will use the money as he likes. One big donor has sued Trump for fraud, having donated $1.5 million to fight election fraud before realizing there's just no there there. Get in line, pal. A German columnist drew an interesting comparison. When Germany lost World War I, the conservatives who had started the war refused to accept the loss. Their denial started the stab-in-the-back myth that liberals and Jews had betrayed the nation. They were as far off base as Trump, but the myth comforted returning soldiers. Years later, Adolf Hitler brilliantly exploited it. Trump's claims of cheating inspire Trump fans to threaten the lives of civil servants who are counting the votes. The threats have required extra police protection for those officials. Georgia Republicans are begging Trump to stop, lest lives be lost. Trump ignores them. Surprise, Trump cares only about Trump. Even most Republicans are staying out of this, but two convicted felons Trump sprang from jail support him. Roger Stone, released early by Barr, said this week that there's, quote, incontrovertible evidence of North Korean boats delivering ballots through a harbor in Maine, unquote. Michael Flynn, pardoned by Trump, said Trump should, quote, temporarily suspend, unquote, the Constitution and redo the election, declaring, quote, partial martial law, whatever that is. Flynn says, quote, the current threat to our United States by the international and domestic socialist communist left is much more serious than anything our nation has faced in its history, including the Civil War. None of this is good for our democracy, and Trump's sideshow distracts from immediate and substantial harms, Trump eviscerating the nonpartisan civil service and illegally pushing congressionally authorized emergency COVID-19 funds out of Biden's reach.
Peter Goodman's columns appear in the Sunday edition of the Las Cruces Sun News. You can also read and listen to him in the local viewpoints section at krwg.org. Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. Finally this week, KRWG Public Media premiered a documentary on a local broadcasting legend. In 1920, a bright young engineer put Las Cruces on the map and on the air. That year, Ralph Willis Goddard, an electrical engineering professor and department head at the New Mexico College of Agriculture and Mechanic Arts, now New Mexico State University, broadcast the first signals from his hand-built radio station on campus. It was one of the first radio broadcasts west of the Mississippi River and the first ever in New Mexico. That small radio station would come to be known as KOB, one of the most powerful in the country. Tragically, Goddard was electrocuted and died in service to the station. Dr. John Hunter is Professor Emeritus in the Department of History at New Mexico State University.
As a consequence of Dean Goddard's sudden and tragic death, as a consequence of all of a sudden this vacuum of leadership for this flagship station of KOB, interest in the radio station dwindled at State College. And so in 1932, it was sold to an Albuquerque company, an Albuquerque firm, and KOB was moved up to Albuquerque, where it continues to be a voice of the Great Southwest, KKOB, both AM and FM. It was a real tragedy for the community, for the university, for the region, to lose this, to have this voice go silent.
Well, of course, Goddard's legacy lives on here at New Mexico State University. The engineering building where he broadcast New Mexico's first radio signals was dedicated way back in 1934 as Goddard Hall. And KRWG Public Media honors Ralph Willis Goddard's legacy in our call letters, his initials. If you didn't get a chance to see this documentary, we have another chance for you on KRWG-TV tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. You can also watch it anytime on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.